criticism has been made and is being made that we sell our souls to Washington. It is a fact of life that the major support for research, particularly when it comes to basic research, comes from federal agencies. Period. That's a fact of life.
That was Dr. Juan Roeder, Dean of the College of Environmental Sciences at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I'm Karen Sedgwell, Director of Public Affairs, with this week's edition of University Focus. The National Science Foundation recently released figures that ranked all universities in terms of federally financed research and development expenditures in fiscal year 78. UAF ranked second among all public universities in environmental sciences research expenditures and ranked 16 in terms of federal support for all the sciences. Needless to say, Dean Roeder is pleased with the news.
We are probably number one nation. The United States is usually quoted as being the leader of at least the Western world. We are a nation of 230 or so million people. We have, about 1,000 universities or so. We may have something like 400 public universities. To be number two in all this in environmental sciences is fantastic, in my opinion. Even to be number 16 when we consider all kind of research, still I would call it formidable.
Dr. Roeder attributes UAF's high ranking in the environmental sciences to the Alaskan environment and the research opportunities it affords.
Quite obviously, Alaska offers a natural scientific laboratory in its environment. In other words, we can study in Alaska processes, phenomena in geophysics, marine sciences, in the biosciences that are related to environmental phenomena. And I think it is natural that Alaska has attracted first-rate scientists.
In answering criticism for extensive federal support, Dr. Roeder noted that to accomplish research goals, universities today have to look to sources for support that are the most adequate and most probable sources. And as he observed, those sources are mainly in Washington. Moreover, there are no strings. Restrictions on research projects are few. Projects must fit into the national goals, but little else is controlled. Dean Roeder did indicate that support from private industry is minimal. He would like to see greater cooperation between the university and industry.
To carry out research for the private industry is quite a, applies in a only a limited area. Private industry usually does not fund basic research unless it is basic research of their own direct interest, in which case usually they do it in-house. Because of the way the system works, we have very little opportunities yet to really use our talent and put our talent to the disposal of the private industry.
It seems great then for the university to receive federal support, but do the state and community really benefit? Dr. Roeder points out that the state and local community do benefit from the federal monies expended. He cites research on permafrost, Arctic pollution, and remote sensing as examples of the resolution of short-term problems, examples of results that have had immediate and visible benefits. Other areas of research, such as work on sea ice, won't realize benefits until 5 to 10 years down the road. In strictly financial terms, however, Roeder argues that benefits have been substantial.
Last year, about $20 million came to the University of Alaska from federal sources for environmental research. Out of these $20 million, I guess something like perhaps $16 million went into salaries. So there you have it. There have been last year $16 million federal dollars that ultimately went into the community because that's where the salary money goes.
Dr. Roeder also noted that the federal support of environmental research at UAF is the outgrowth of seed money received from the state of Alaska. A new year brings a new semester at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The men's and women's basketball teams will be returning to the far north after competing in the Chico State Invitational in sunny California. The men will play their first home game of the year on January 11th against California Baptist College. Registration begins the 15th and classes get underway on the 21st. I'm Karen Sedgwick, and this has been University Focus from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where education and research face tomorrow today.
University Focus is produced by the UAF Public Affairs Office at KUAC-FM.
The seaworthiness of ships may not be that much greater than our Kona, but her size makes it much more practical to be out on some of Alaska's rather rough waters, especially the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea. She's also got some ice strengthening. She's got infinitely better laboratory space, and we can accommodate more scientists at a time. So the type of work, the type of interdisciplinary work that we do will be very much enhanced by having this ship available.
That was Dr. Vera Alexander, the newly appointed director of the Institute of Marine Science. And I'm Karen Sedgwick, the director of public affairs at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, with this week's edition of University Focus. The Institute of Marine Science not only received a new director this week, but it also acquired a new and bigger ship. Dr. Alexander was in Seattle this week to sign a charter party agreement under which UAF will operate the Alpha Helix, a 133-foot vessel that replaces the Acona. Negotiations have been underway for nearly a year as UAF sought the larger ship, which had been owned by the Scripps Institution. Dr. Alexander explained some of the difficulty in acquiring the Alpha Helix.
This particular ship is rather exceptional in that it was built specifically for the Scripps Institution of Oceanography for physiological and biological research. And for many years it was a dedicated ship to that kind of work, even though it was used as a national facility. In other words, anybody with a program could have a chance at going out on her. But it turned out it was getting harder and harder to put these expeditions together, and it was decided to terminate this national facility status and make the ship one of the regular United States academic fleet. But this took time because the Scripps Institution held the title, and they were not very eager to give it up. And they tried everything to try to create programs and create means whereby they could keep the ship, even though they couldn't really do this because even though they owned it, the National Science Foundation had the right to decide what happened to the ship, and that was part of the initial grant to construct her.
Most of the ships used by American universities are owned by the National Science Foundation, with the exception of one or two that are owned by the Navy. The ships are assigned to the University National Oceanographic Laboratory System, or UNOL, that is funded by the NSF and headquartered in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. It is the organization that handles all ship scheduling and all arrangements. Although the Alpha Helix will enhance the type of research conducted by the Institute, modifications have to be made.
Because she was not built for oceanography, there are some changes that have to be made. She's quite flat-bottomed. She was meant to be anchored in bays here and there, and or go up the Amazon, just anything, rather than go out in a rough sea and hold a position very accurately. In order for her to do this, we have to make some modifications, one of them being put on a keel. She doesn't have a keel at all now. And also we need to put on another engine and a bow thruster, another propeller at the bow, so that we can control position more accurately. We have to move some of the heavy equipment lower down from the upper deck from the heavy winches because she's not stable enough for working in the open sea in rough waters right now. And so there are going to be quite a few modifications, some of which will be done now, hopefully, as soon as we can get her in the shipyard. Some may have to wait while we order some of the equipment and parts till the fall. So we don't know exactly how long she'll be in the shipyard right now. We hope to have her up here by May, but maybe not till June or July if you have more done and can show a little more slowly.
A bond issue that was approved in the last general election is providing funds to build a dock at the INS station in Seward. Although the facility is sorely needed, the presently planned dock will barely accommodate the larger ship or visiting research vessels.
Well, the present dock that we are going to be constructing this next summer is entirely funded by a bond issue through the state of Alaska. Unfortunately, it has taken some time, as usual, to do the planning and get the bids out and so on and so forth, and it turns out in the end that the dock is less than we had hoped it would be or will be less. It will be somewhat shorter. It will not have some of the utilities and other things that are needed on an oceanographic dock. But hopefully by building on what we can start this summer, we will have a viable dock, because at present at the station we have no dock at all. We are having to use a small boat harbor in Seward, and the outer hills simply won't fit in there. They won't even consider letting her in there. In fact, they consider the economy too much for that harbor. So we're definitely going to have to come up with an alternative solution.
Dr. Alexander is hopeful that state assistance will permit expansion of the Seward facility.
Because one of the best things we could do would be to expand on the present planned dock, at least to make it big enough to accommodate visiting oceanographic ships and to make it more secure for the Alpha Helix on a year-round basis. Preferably, we would like to, of course, expand the dock system considerably and have a major oceanographic facility there, but that may take some time.
A new ship and new dock won't be enough to satisfy the energetic new director. Alexander cites research to tackle Alaska's coastal problems as a key project for the Institute. She'd like to see a thorough evaluation of the ecosystem of Prince William Sound. The upcoming week is filled with activities. Tonight at 8, the men's basketball team takes on California Baptist in the Nanooks' first home game since their return from a successful road trip. The Nanooks are 10-3 for the season. The residence halls open Sunday, the lower commons and library open Monday, and the pub resumes business on Wednesday. Registration is from 11 to 5 on Thursday and from 10 to 8 on Friday for regular students. Special students register during express registration Friday from 5 to 8. The first day of classes is Monday, January 21st. I'm Karen Sedgell, and this has been University Focus from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where education and research face tomorrow today.
University Focus is produced by the UAF Public Affairs Office at KUAC-FM.
I find an awful lot of these objects in very good condition. I think they've been well cared for here, at least well stored, most of them, not all. And I'm generally very pleased to see that most of them are in such good condition. As I was preparing to come to Alaska, I did a lot of reading on Eskimos and Athabascans, and I must admit that I was really taken in by all of it, so it's awfully nice now to work on these types of objects.
That was Laura Word, one of two conservators affiliated with the Smithsonian Institution who are spending the month of January working at the University of Alaska Museum. And I'm Karen Sedgell, the Director of Public Affairs at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, with this week's edition of University Focus. Supported by funds from a donation by Alaskan bush pilot Robert Bod Reeve, Thurid Clark and Laura Word are cleaning and repairing objects that will be on display in the new museum building that will open officially in May. One of the more challenging projects has been their work on an Eskimo umiak from Barrow. Laura Word explains the problem.
There's a separation of the skin about 4 or 5 inches across, and it extends all the way from one gunwale to the next one, to the one on the other side. So it extends the whole width of the umiak. The separation is about 4 to 5 inches, and what we have to do is patch that area of loss, and basically camouflage it so it's not that distracting.
And Thurid Clark explains the difficulty in repairing the hole.
We've been trying to get lashing, always lashing, to relash it, because that seems to be one of the hardest hit points, that's the stress point on the hide, and much of the old lashing is broken and it's very brittle. What happens is that this environment is so very, very dry, and we're supposed to need to be in water, that the skin shrinks unnaturally. It was never meant to be in a dry, 35 relative humidity building. And it has gone through incredible stresses and changes. And the problem is that if we could find lashing that was done by natives around here, it would undergo that same shrinking process again, and put even more tension on the two umiak that's been too much already.
Word said repair of the umiak would take a full week of their time. He also said the repair and preservation of artifacts takes patience and research.
Normally we do research the historical background of an object. We try to find out obviously, where it was made, who made it, when it was made, the nature of the material, how they made it, the technology that was involved in forming that object, because a lot of times that can help us decide what we want to do to conserve it.
A good portion of the work done by the tree is to understand and foresee how the component objects interact with the different materials available to repair articles. Both also commented on the variety of objects housed here. As Laura Word put it, "We've worked on everything from furniture to the delicate pieces of ivory, from masks to a loonskin headdress." The two conservators believe their work on the Alaskan native artifacts has provided pleasure and satisfaction. Even the casual visitor to the University of Alaska Museum has shared those same feelings. Registration ends at 8 p.m. today. Classes begin Monday. The Women's Varsity plays the University of Puget Sound at 6 tonight and at 8 p.m. on Saturday. Men's basketball sees our Fly in the Nooks up against Hard Plains St. Martin's again tonight at 8 following the women. Movies on campus this weekend are Love at First Bite and Fast Break, a double feature held both nights in the concert hall. The Farthest North War Games group meets Saturday night in Brooks 406 from 6 till midnight. And the Board of Regents will be on campus the 24th and 25th. I'm Karen Sedgo, and this has been University Focus from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where education and research face tomorrow today.
University Focus is produced by the UAF Public Affairs Office at KUAC-FM.
We thought there was a flow, essentially a river in the sea, that came in through the Aleutian Passes and looped, percolated around Bristol Bay and out of Bristol Bay and then flowed on to the north and out to Bering Strait. And we thought, well, we can start at one point sort of upstream in the river, and that's where the fish are spawning, and then and as they move downstream, the eggs are getting older and they must be eating, and it was all a very nice scheme. So we thought, well, we'll start here this year and move downstream as we go, and that turned out to be all wrong.
That was Dr. Peter McRoy, the chief scientist of the PROBES project and associate professor with the Institute of Marine Science. And I'm Karen Sedgo, director of public affairs at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, with this week's edition of University Focus. PROBES, or Processes and Resources of the Bering Sea Shelf, is a six-year interdisciplinary and multi-institutional project centered at UAF's Institute of Marine Science. The major effort is to understand the processes that contribute to the active production of marine life such as crabs, fish, birds, and mammals in certain areas of the Bering Sea over the outer continental shelf. The project received a vote of confidence recently when the National Science Foundation extended project life in 1983 and approved an additional $3.7 million in support funds. The discovery that there are two lakes in the shelf with distinct types of activity rather than a system of rivers was significant, according to Dr. McRoy.
In the outer lake, because of the proximity to the open ocean, we get a good population of grazing animals. So all the plants that are produced are eaten. So there's a very effective food chain there. And once we thought about that, we said, oh, that's interesting. Then we took other things, like the distribution of whales from the Bering Sea. Son of a gun, all the plankton-eating whales are staying in the outer lake. We looked at then the benthic fisheries data, king crab, flounders, and things like that from the National Fisheries Service, and it's there all along. Here are the boundaries, and the fisheries, without knowing that, have essentially been doing it for years. So what we think we've got now, and one of the significance of the project to the state, is we've got the oceanographic basis for both the pelagic fisheries, like the pollock fishery in the Bering Sea, and as well as the benthic fisheries. Yeah. We know why they're where they are, why they're that productive, and what the boundaries are, what the limits are on. Probably the same as would be true for marine mammals. And that's a real breakthrough.
PROBES coordinator Dr. John Gearing, who is also located here at UAF, observes that the research data will greatly assist the state in its management of Bering Sea resources.
So as Peter pointed out, we think we have some clues as to why the study species are where they are. And also, hopefully, by the end of February, we may have some good information as to amount of particular type of species that the sea can produce. Yeah, so I think that's where most of our input would probably contribute, don't you think, Peter?
Yeah, that, and the other thing that I think is important is that we think we have a pretty good grasp of how it works now. We know where this thing, where the organisms are, where the biomass is. We think we know how it's being produced and what are the crucial steps in the system. What that means is that we should have a good handle on, like, the impact problems that are always a big threat to offshore development in the state. We ought to be able to provide that information to say, well, this is what could be the consequences in this part of the Bering Sea as opposed to this part, and here it would be better than there, perhaps. It's that kind of understanding that that they've been looking for, and that should be a valuable spin-off from folks.
Spin-offs and long-term benefits include equipment that is soon to be installed at UAF, as Dr. Gearing explains.
We're just in the process of installing an antenna on the building of O'Neill building, where we'll be able to interrogate the satellites. We'll use satellite links to feed and to receive data from the computer system in down in California. And the reason is that there's some considerable interest for also for non-probe people is the possibility of using this satellite to communicate with people in various parts of the state and villages and so on.
Both Gearing and McCroy point out the benefits of probes are many. Basic Data Collective will explain why Bering Sea resources are located as they are. This knowledge will assist the state in its management of Bering Sea resources. Students are attracted to UAF because of the quality of the project and likely exposure to scientists from other institutions. Both also note that probes has established the value of cooperative, interdisciplinary, and multi-institutional research. Our students are back and classes have begun. Monday is the last day of late registration and the last day to add a class. Tonight, the Nanuk hockey team takes on the University of Alaska Anchorage in a game that promises to be full of action and emotion. Tomorrow afternoon, the UAF Fire Department is holding an open house to celebrate new lower insurance rates for those living in the University District Service Area and to show off their recently acquired equipment. Come Saturday, anytime between 1 and 5. And Wood Energy is being discussed Saturday from noon until 5 in Wood Center. Movies this weekend in the concert hall include Days of Heaven and What's Up, Doc? I'm Karen Sedgo, and this has been University Focus from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where education and research face tomorrow, today.
University Focus is produced by the UAF Public Affairs Office at KUAC-FM.
University of Alaska Fairbanks, we have the highest headcount for a spring semester than in the history of the university. Over 3,300 students have registered thus far, and they are carrying 32,739 student credit hours.
That was Anne Tamarello, the Director of Admissions and Records at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I'm Karen Sedgo, the Director of Public Affairs, with this week's edition of University Focus. Enrollment figures are critical to a university. Program expansion, budget increases, and new facilities and equipment all hinge on enrollment. The students do count. Naturally, Anne Tamarello is pleased about the spring 80 figures at UAF. This semester sees the highest head count ever for spring semester.
This is the highest spring semester enrollment we have had at the university. Traditionally, the spring semester enrollment is always as much as 10% lower than the fall semester. We have enjoyed a fine increase in enrollment since our fall semester 1975, when our enrollment was about 2,500 students.
Did that reflect any pipeline impact that year?
I think very definitely it did. We saw a big drop in our enrollment from the 74-75 school year. And that was about the time that the pipeline started up. And then as the pipeline has dropped off as far as the numbers of people employed, we have enjoyed a rise in our enrollment, particularly in the numbers of full-time regular degree students who've been returning to the campus.
Since the oil pipeline activity has subsided, UAF has enjoyed a steady growth in enrollment.
We've had some bigger increases from one year over another. But overall, it's been a very steady, healthy growth, we think. And we have now the largest number of student credit hours produced during the 1980-81 or 79-80 academic year than we've ever had before.
Although enrollment figures look exceptionally good for the past 5 years, Samarello notes that student credit hours have yet to exceed a 1973 total. But a national trend indicates that more adults are returning to school to pursue an education, and the older, more mature students tend to be part-timers.
We have about 60% of our students are full-time students. Our statistics show us that the students are averaging fewer credits per semester, which indicates more part-time students. And this is a trend that has been prevalent in the colleges and universities in the other parts of the country, and certainly we are following the same trend here. We have more students than we've ever had before, but they are carrying, on the average, fewer credits, which indicates that many of the older students, and in quotes I say older, I mean more mature individuals, are returning to the campuses, again, which is a national trend. And these people take lighter loads because many of them are employed, many of them are wives with children at home that they must care for, and they aren't able to take a normal load of 17, 18 credits a semester. They may take 9 or 10 a semester and just take longer to complete their degree.
According to Admissions Director Ann Samarello, UAF is doing more recruiting both inside and outside the state. However, she believes enrollment is tied to the economy of the state. Projects like the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline tend to attract students to the job market. High unemployment has seen the classroom swell, but UAF isn't complaining about the number of students. Another month begins today, and the activity on campus shows signs of spring despite continued cold weather. Tonight and Saturday night have both the men's and women's basketball teams playing at home. The men take on Simon Fraser from British Columbia at 8 both nights, and the women tackle 16th-ranked Western Washington at 6 p.m. ASUA is sponsoring a midnight movie beginning 11:30 p.m. on Saturday in Scheibel Hall in the Bunnell Building. The movie is Wuthering Heights. On Sunday at 4, the Arctic Chamber Orchestra will present a concert featuring the music of Handel. The performance will be held in the Fine Arts Concert Hall. I'm Karen Sedgill, and this has been University Focus from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where education and research take tomorrow today.
University Focus is produced by the UAF Public Affairs Office at KUAC-FM.
There's definitely a style in hockey. It's not all violence. There's certain teams that might put violence into the game, but I think it got carried away a few times, and people were starting to pay a little more attention to the body contact and the contact of the sport, and I think it was over exaggerated a little bit, but as far as our game of hockey is concerned, it's actually a good, fast game, and part of the game is body contact. But like I said, it can get violent sometimes depending on individual players. But it's not really a violent game, I would say. It's a hard-hitting, hard body contact sport.
That was Tim Wagner, hockey coach at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I'm Karen Sedgill, Director of Public Affairs, with this week's edition of University Focus. Hockey was discontinued as a varsity sport in 1974 at UAF. Construction of a 1,300... ice arena brought about its return this academic year. Tim Wagoner was selected only a few weeks ago to finish out the season as coach for the fledgling Nanook team. According to Wagoner, the first year is particularly demanding for a new team as the players learn to work together.
It takes time to recruit good players, and it takes a lot of time for the guys to get together as a team and to form a good team. You have to work together for a couple of years and get to know how each other plays and things like this. So it takes a few years, a good couple of years to get a good, solid, what you would call a team, to play as a team instead of individuals.
Is hockey dependent upon teams
coordination, or do you have like the single stars that make or break the game?
Well, there's a lot of good teams that have single stars, but I think for a real good, solid team, you have to depend on everybody as a team and, you know, to work totally together as a team. You can get along better. Everybody, you keep more consistent that way. That way you don't have to depend on your certain stars to pull you through certain games. But if you have a good, solid team where everybody works together and everybody's consistently scoring, like if one line's not making the goals, hopefully the other line will make the goals. That way you don't have to depend on one certain player or two certain players to pull you through all the time.
In assessing the Nan Oaks, Wagner said the hockey team has a lot to work at, but winning is a goal.
The strong point is they do have desire. They want to play good hockey, you know. But the main thing is we have to work on just position. I think their position is the main thing. They're just not used to playing this brand of hockey, and they're bunching up a lot. Right? And they just have to spread out a little bit and get their passing down and play good position. And working on a forechecking system now. And that's real important, you know, to try to bottle the other team up in their own end and hopefully get a few more shots on goal. And the more shots you get, hopefully the more goals you'll get. And I think another real strong thing is not just bottling the other team up in their end, but getting the puck out of our end too is a real strong point that we're trying to work on a lot now. In practice, we've been working on it a lot the last couple weeks. But, you know, just getting out of our own end, because a lot of times you run across a team that has a good forechecking system and you'll be caught in your own end the whole game.
A search committee to select a full-time hockey coach is now underway. A 24-game schedule for 8081 includes 12 home games and 2 road trips. And a booster club has been formed to promote the team and to raise funds for a hockey scholarship. For Fairbanks hockey enthusiasts, UAF promises more action as the Nan Oaks learn the ice and leave no skate blade dull. Infectious spring weather makes it hard to stay in the classroom. Coats are open or non-existent, skis are everywhere. The women's basketball team takes on Seattle Pacific tonight and Saturday at 8 in the Patty Gym. Then the Lady Nan Oaks hit the road next week. The men's team is on the road and will play Central Washington and St. Martin's this weekend. ASUA movies for the weekend are China Syndrome and Play It Again, Sam. Movies begin at 6:40 p.m. in the Fine Arts Concert Hall. And the 27th Annual Conservation and Resource Management Workshop will be held on campus Monday through Friday. Another workshop, this one on management training for interior villages, will also take place on campus through the week. I'm Karen Sedzo, and this has been University Focus from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where education and research face tomorrow, today.
University Focus is produced by the UAF Public Affairs Office at KUAC-FM. I'm quite heartened by this grant, of course, and I think, for one thing, it shows that the University of Alaska Fairbanks is very much interested in faculty development. It's a task that I've taken particular interest in since I came to to the Chancellor's office 3 years ago, and I think that it does indicate clearly that the University of Alaska Fairbanks is interested in faculty development. And therefore the improvement of the services that we provide to students and therefore to the state of Alaska.
That was Larry Dennett, Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I'm Karen Sedzo, Director of Public Affairs, with this week's edition of University Focus. Vice Chancellor Dennett is heartened about a $245,000 5-year grant from the Andrew Mellon Foundation. It is making a wide range of opportunities available to UAF faculty. The grant is intended to strengthen UAF faculty and curriculum development program and is allocated for a variety of programs.
We have several parts of this faculty and curriculum development program. One of those is mini grants for the improvement of teaching and research. Another is professional travel to allow faculty to attend meetings of professional societies and professional committees and that sort of thing.
We also have a program of special leave, which will be used to allow faculty to reorient their expertise in areas of developing curricular needs. There is also some money in this grant for a library needs assessment and development plan. Also, there are funds to support interdisciplinary faculty discussion groups, and also some money for a program of orientation for new faculty to conditions and interests in rural Alaska.
The first travel grants were awarded several weeks ago, and just recently, 17 UAF faculty members were recipients of $500 mini-grants to be used for the improvement of teaching and research.
Professor Charles Janot of the Chemistry Department will use some of this money to produce videotapes that will be used to communicate selected lecture and demonstration materials in his course in introductory chemistry. That's one example. Another example is Professor Richard Mave of the College of Environmental Sciences will use his mini-grant to have duplicate slides produced of marine pathology specimens. This will allow him to do a better job in the classroom in the graduate courses in marine science. Professor Arvin Fukin of the School of Engineering will use his mini-grant for the preparation of slides and transparencies and some case histories for his courses on in frozen ground engineering and in slope stability. Professor Abby Gorham of the Economics Department will use her grant for travel expenses to bring two Alaskan economists to Fairbanks to hold seminars for faculty and students on Alaskan economic issues and policies. So those are some examples of the kinds of things that these 17 mini-grants are being used for this spring.
The $245,000 grant received in January is actually a spin-off from last summer's pilot rural orientation program, which Mellon funded. Faculty response to that program, which took newly arrived faculty to the bush, and to the five-year grant, has been positive, according to Bennett.
These first two programs that we funded, the travel grants and the mini-grants for improvement of teaching and research, both have attracted great interest on the part of the faculty. For example, the travel program, we were able to fund 11 proposals, and we had 42 proposals for the use of those funds. In the case of the mini-grants, which I've just talked about, we had proposals that would have used about $19,000, and we were able to allocate only $10,000 for that portion of the grant for this spring. So we've had great interest on the part of the faculty.
Bennett believes the support from the Mellon Foundation is indicative of UAF's future capability to attract the support of national foundations.
The Mellon Foundation generally supports private institutions rather than public institutions, and typically their funds are used for what they call pilot projects or development projects rather than long-term projects. So I think they're expecting that that the projects that we're able to support through this grant will be used not only to support faculty and system development, but also to help us decide what kinds of projects are particularly effective and that then might be funded over the long run from state funds. Of course, we have no promise that those funds will be available, but it's sort of a trial run in each case to see which kinds of things really work, which are worth supporting. I would also say that because the Mellon Foundation more typically funds private institutions, it's really quite an honor that we as a public institution have been selected as a recipient of this grant.
A rural orientation program will be conducted again this summer, and UAF faculty will continue to submit unique proposals over the years to use the grant money for professional development and course enrichment. Tonight is the premiere of the UA Drama Workshop's first spring production, What the Butler Saw. It's an adult comedy, and there is no butler. Curtain is at 8:15. The show will continue Saturday and next weekend. The movie this weekend is Animal House. It will show at 6:40 p.m. in the Fine Arts Concert Hall. The midnight movie on Saturday in Seibel Hall at 11:30 p.m. is Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. The Lady Nan Oaks play against Anchorage both tonight and Saturday night at 8 in the Patty Gym. There's a special lecture on cabin fever in the Wood Center Pub on Tuesday, March 4th at 4:30 p.m. A hockey booster club has been formed to promote UAF hockey, and the UA Friends of the Museum are looking for new members. Check with the Public Affairs Office for details. I'm Karen Sedgo, and this has been University Focus from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where education and research face tomorrow today.
University Focus is produced by the UAF Public Affairs Office at KUAC-FM.
It's a two-week time of special programs, both on radio and TV. And it's also a chance for us to reach out to the community and ask for their support, both financially and in terms of their comments and questions.
That was Tim Karpoff, the coordinator of KUAC's Festival 80. And I'm Karen Sedgo, director of public affairs at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, with this week's edition of University Focus. Festival 80 is KUAC-TV and KUAC-FM's second annual appeal for financial support from the Fairbanks community. KUAC's goal is $60,000 this year.
Why do you need financial support? Aren't the taxpayers already funding KUAC?
KUAC is affiliated with the University of Alaska, and therefore most of its funding does come from the state. We do get certain federal matching funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and that's where most of our program costs are paid out of. The state money pay for a lot of the administration and overhead around the operating cost of the station. Our program costs have really gone out of sight, and we don't recover that through normal tax dollars or our matching funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And we're asking the community to help directly support our programming through their financial contributions. And we feel that gives them a chance to invest in the product that they've kind of come to expect. We have had certain dramatic price increases. A radio reader on FM has gone up from 600% in costs. Great Performances has gone up $6,000 in 1 year, and Nova has gone up Sesame Street. You know, we really do have a lot of additional costs to absorb.
What about somebody who really is supportive of KUAC, but at this point in time isn't able to do anything financially? Can they contribute in other ways?
Yes. In fact, I really want to emphasize that Festival 80 is not just a hard sell for money. It's a two-week time when KUAC is reaching out to the community in several ways. We're trying to raise the awareness that it is public broadcasting and that people do have a stake in what they hear and see over the public broadcasting network. That means that we're really soliciting people's comments and questions about our programs. We want to know what people like, what they don't like, in terms of programs or the schedules, the present schedule of the programs.
But is that going to pay off? I mean, if someone's upset with the type of programming or really likes a certain program and they even bother to make a comment, are the comments actually considered and acted upon?
Yes. We base our decisions heavily, our purchasing decisions and our scheduling decisions heavily on what we hear from the public. That's really our only way of knowing whether we're reaching out and making an impact on the community, is if people tell us. Of course, we don't have commercials, so we don't gauge our effectiveness that way. It's direct public feedback that we operate on that tells us whether we're doing an effective job in as far as our programming goes, or whether we're not.
Festival 80 runs for a certain period of time, but does that mean that somebody that wants to contribute money or wants to make a comment can only do so during that period of time?
No, but that's when we're really making a concerted effort. We want to take 2 weeks out of the year to ask for people's financial support, certainly. We don't want to intrude on their normal listening and viewing time any more than that. And it is, you know, financial contributions are a sensitive topic, so we want to respect that as much as possible. So we take 2 weeks out of the year, and it's a chance where people can get involved more directly in the station, see our operation. We have over 200 volunteers who will have, by the 16th, trooped in and answered phones or provided refreshments or run errands, that kind of help. It's also time when we're really actively soliciting the comments, but they're welcome all year round.
March is full of activities. This is the last weekend to see What the Butler Saw at 8:15 both Friday and Saturday night. James Bond movies are featured this weekend. Moonraker and Thunderball will be shown in the concert hall at 6:40 Friday night, 9:30 p.m. Saturday. If you like the guitar, you'll enjoy the Carlos Montoya concert Saturday night at 7 in the Fine Arts Concert Hall. A faculty art show is underway in room 301 of the Fine Arts Building. The Festival of Native Arts opens Monday and continues through the 14th. The second annual agricultural symposium is still open for registration. It will be conducted in the Wood Center Ballroom March 14th and 15th. UA President Jay Barton will make the opening address, and Governor Jay Hammond is the featured speaker at Friday night's banquet. And don't forget, Festival 80 runs through March 16th. I'm Karen Sedzo, and this has been University Focus from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where education and research face tomorrow, today.
University Focus is produced by the UAF Public Affairs Office at KUAC-FM.